is which is that you can you have this. Listen to the other talks, get sleep, prepare your own talk, and you can choose two. So I chose, I didn't choose this one. okay, this talk, I've tried to insert the classical quantum divide here. Just goes on. I don't think I need so much space for the for the classical side, so it goes there. So let's start with the equivalence principle. This is Einstein's equivalence principle, and this is one way to state the equivalence principle. For any point, it's possible to find a coordinate system with respect to which we have inertial behavior in the vicinity of that point. So of course, if you are in such a coordinate system at such a point, if you consider a trajectory, then the trajectory is moving, is going to move inertially along a geodesic in this coordinate system. So along in a straight line in this coordinate system. And so this will be the coordinate system, in the falling elevator, so to speak. And the reason I state the equivalence principle like this is because I want to discuss a possible quantum equivalence principle. So this is what I call the quantum equivalence principle. And this states that for any point, any given point, it's possible to find a quantum coordinate system with respect to which we have definite causal structure. In the vicinity of that point. And actually, this address a question.
I hope this is helpful. It's not helpful. What's a point?
That's a very good question, yeah. And hopefully I can give you an answer to that question much later in the talk if I get time. Yeah. In fact, there's many questions. Also, what is a quantum coordinate system? I mean, what is the vicinity? Sure. I mean, so if you can answer the question, what is a quantum coordinate system, then you have an answer to what is the question, what is a point, and what is a vicinity. So really what I need is an answer to this question. And when I first posed this principle, I didn't have an answer to this question. But this idea of a quantum coordinate system is, of course, motivated by the work that Femenia spoke about on quantum reference frames. I mean, there's a quantum coordinate system and quantum reference frames are really the same idea. So two questions. First of all, why might it be useful to set up a quantum equivalence principle as I've described it? And the second question is, how can we implement this principle? And in particular, that means answering this question of what a quantum coordinate system is. So I'm going to discuss one particular way on how to implement a quantum coordinate system. But I should say that the sort of related work here, so this is really a sort of continuous idea where you have continuous quantum coordinates of some sort, but there's a sort of discrete notion of this kind that comes up in the work of Philip Allard Guérin and Czaslaw Bruckner, and also correspondingly in on Jonareskov's papers, where you have a kind of discrete circuit, and you can transform between different ways of representing that circuit, which are equivalent, in which an operation is either localized or delocalized. So that's a sort of discrete implementation of something like this. Other things, so Thomas Galli is looking at the quantum switch with respect to the quantum reference frame approach has some preliminary results sort of looking like he might be able to implement this kind of idea too. Okay. Maybe I can do this here. So to motivate what I'm going to say, especially the answer to the first question, why might this be useful? I want to look at an analogous situation. This is very much in the spirit of what Doreen was speaking about this morning. So I'm motivated by an analogy. And this is, because ultimately we're interested in the problem of quantum gravity, but there's an analogous problem, which I'm going to call the problem of relativistic gravity. And the problem of relativistic gravity is, or was, to solve, to find a theory, let's call it relativistic gravity, which limits to Newtonian gravity on the one hand, and to special relativistic field theories like Maxwell's equations on the other hand. This problem was solved, of course, by Einstein when he came up with the theory of general relativity. And the way he solved that, well, I mean, it was pure genius, really. But certainly, the equivalence principle played a very important role in motivating the framework that he invented. And actually, in this framework that he invents, the equivalence principle is a kind of bridging principle between special relativistic field theories on the one hand, and the theory he found on the other hand. So here you have global inertial behavior. You have always global inertial behavior. And then you bridge to a situation where you only have it locally, nevertheless you can get some constraints that help you construct the right equations. So let's expand this out a little bit. So I'm going to talk about. I'm going to try and draw a relatively big diagram here. So here I want to do the elements of general relativity. It took me a long time to get comfortable with the theory of general relativity. And then when I finally saw it from this point of view, I felt like I had a greater sense of comfort. So here are what I would describe as the basic elements of general relativity. First of all, we have a prescription. And what this does is it tells you how to take equations from special relativistic field theories and turn them into equations for general relativistic field theories. So this is the rule where you replace partial derivatives with covariant derivatives. You replace coordinates which are in a specific inertial coordinate system with general coordinates. And then also you replace the Minkowski metric by the general metric. So this prescription takes you from a set of special relativistic field theory equations to ones that are suitable, which are correct in general relativity. So there's a map from here to here. The second thing is, when you do this, You might start off with a set of equations which are complete, so that if you know sufficient boundary information, you can solve and get solutions. But then it turns out that after when you replace eta, which is a constant matrix, with G, which has 10 variable parameters, then you no longer have enough equations. So you need an addendum and these are the Einstein field equations. Okay. So that works well, except that it turns out that the left-hand side of the Einstein field equations is subject to a mathematical identity. The covariant derivative of it is identically zero. So although it looked like you had 10 equations, it turns out you only have 6 independent equations. And that's because all these equations are generally covariant, so it had better be that way, in fact. And this connects with the final point, which is the interpretation. And the interpretation is that any solution you write down is physically equivalent to any other solution which you can obtain by a general coordinate transformation on that solution, or more abstractly, by a diffeomorphism on that solution. Or in other words, the Buebles are independent. The Buebles are those functions on solutions which are independent of diffeomorphisms. Okay. And I forgot to mention here, so here we have Newton's gravity, and there is a role here when you derive the Einstein field equations. Newton's the equations are used in part to motivate the particular form that you choose there. So there's more structure here. There's a bunch of principles. So we have one principle is the equivalence principle. Which I've talked about already. And that plays a role in motivating how you implement this prescription. You're looking for a way to do it such that you still have special relativistic field theory locally. So that's what this does. There's the principle of general covariance. And all the equations that you find here have to be invariant in that way. And there's also energy conservation. And there's also a box over here, which we can draw. With some math in it, or maths.
What's energy conservation?
Sorry,
why energy conservation?
Well, because when you part of the motivation for the form of these Einstein field equations is that you get that the covariant derivative of t mu is equal to zero. So Einstein is looking for that.
You mean covariant conservation? So the covariant conservation.
Sure. Yeah, and sure. I know that they're different, but the point is this what I'm trying to describe here is the sort of landscape of different ideas within which the heuristics of setting up general relativity is obtained. So I'm not trying to give you a careful axiomatic derivation of quantum theory. That's an interesting project, but it's not the one.
But I think what you mean is not that energy is conserved, but that the energy momentum tensor obeys the equation T mu nu semicolon nu summed over nu equals zero.
So over here you have energy conservation.
Yes.
And then, up here, you expect this kind of thing to work. You end up getting the equation you're talking about. So over here, a bunch of mathematics. So one thing that we need is the notion of general coordinates. Notion of manifolds. Tensors. Covariant derivatives. And there's many more things we can choose to put in this box. Okay. We could also imagine more principles, although when you look at the paper of Einstein from 1916, these seem to be the key ones that played a role in his thinking. So a principle, for example, that you might want to put here is locality. But actually, he doesn't seem to use locality causality, the idea that signals don't travel faster than light. He doesn't seem to explicitly use that principle in deriving general relativity, even though it's an important principle that surely was at the back of his mind. Okay. So, yeah, so the equivalence principle plays an important role in this whole schema. You can draw lots of lines here. There's a line up here, and then there's a line down here. And in the paper I have on the archive, I've tried to fill this diagram out with lots of different lines of influence to get an idea of how these different ideas flow together. And then there's two more lines you can draw which are important, maybe contain an important lesson for the problem of quantum gravity. So if you look at this scheme and ask, how does it solve the problem of relativistic gravity? Well, what it does is, if you take the prescription, so the equations you get under these substitutions, and you take the limit as you know, under appropriate circumstances, so the curvature goes to zero, then you get back these equations. Okay, Lee?
Is it anywhere in this list that there should be a speed of light to infinity limit that has gravity? I don't see anything that says that it could just be some random difference.
Speed of light. Does that reasoning appear in Einstein's original paper? Okay.
So the idea that the Einstein equations are picked because there's a limit of them that reimburse that.
Right.
Introduces del squared phi equals 16 pi g.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of in here, I think, but maybe not as strongly as you want. Perhaps that could be brought out more in this schema. I think actually this is kind of good work to do to really look at the structure of what's going on here, and also if one can come up with better structures than the one that Einstein did. Does it? Yeah, and I didn't put that here. Maybe I should. It's not quite clear where the arrows go.
Isn't it in the Newtonian gravity limit already?
Maybe. Speed of light. This point that Lee was making before. Maybe it's in here. So I was going to let me finish the point I was making, because I think you can add to this graph, to this diagram a lot. It's really just meant to be a set of ideas that go together. You can do a lot more. So the other point is, so I was trying to explain how this problem is solved, and you can see it very directly because here you have the limit to special relativistic field theories, and here you have the limit to Newton's gravity from Einstein's field equations. So it's extremely clear. And what's interesting is that it solves the problem of relativistic gravity in a very even-handed fashion. You have to change both of them. Not in the same way, but both Newtonian gravity and the special relativistic field equations are changed. There's new physics in both cases. Okay. So let's see if I've made all the points I want to make. Okay, so so now the problem of quantum gravity. So this is to find a theory that limits in appropriate circumstances to general relativity on the one hand and to special relativistic quantum field theories on the other hand. In this case, the new thing was that you didn't have a global inertial reference frame. In some sense, inertiality was now at play. And the point of view I want to explore is that in this situation, the new thing is lack of definite causal structure. You don't generally have global definite causal structure. But maybe this quantum equivalence principle can play a similar role in trying to solve this problem from what the equivalence principle did in the case of general relativity. Okay. So one can just, to explore that idea, one can just draw a similar diagram, but insert the word quantum in lots of different places. So let me do that. So we want a prescription, perhaps using the quantum equivalence principle in some analogous fashion, for taking the equations of whatever version of quantum field theory you have and making them appropriate for quantum gravity, so analogous to what was done in the case of general relativity. We want, when we do that, we're going to introduce extra variables, so we want an addendum. And these will be some extra equations that complete this now into a fully predictive scheme, albeit probabilistic. And then we want an interpretation. The old theories are special relativistic quantum theory. And general relativity. So the new has become the old over here. We might imagine there's some principles. We could look at analogous principles. So we could have the quantum equivalence principle. If we can set up a notion of quantum coordinates, of general quantum coordinates, then we'll have something like the general quantum covariance, the principle of general quantum covariance. And then I'm not sure how energy conservation will look. I'll just place it here. And there's a whole bunch of mathematical structure that we might try to derive by analogy. So general quantum coordinates. Quantum manifolds. Quantum tensor fields. At a certain point, I'm just putting the word quantum in front of stuff here. Quantum covariant derivative. And I don't know, I mean, I don't really have much of this at all, but I have a few ideas. So I have a notion of a quantum equivalence principle that I've given you. I have a notion of general quantum coordinates that I'm hoping I'll get time to describe. And then one can also say something about the interpretation here as well. Okay. All right. Okay, so let's just talk a bit about, let's see how much time I have. Okay, how long do I have?
I would say 30 or 40 minutes.
Okay, good. Yeah, I understand, yeah. Okay, I may give you an abridged version of this. So now we're just in the, we're on the classical side of the classical quantum divide here. We have so I want to consider this kind of classical description. So U will denote the following thing. So basically, it's going to denote where you place tensor fields at each point in a manifold or a part of a manifold. So phi is meant to be the tensor fields, is a list of tensor fields associated with, well, the metric, and then the various matter tensor fields that you have in the physical situation you're considering. And then the idea here is that on a manifold, we place at each point P some values for those tensor fields. Okay, so we just have a manifold with tensor fields on it. Okay. A few comments. Well, first of all, this manifold might just be part of a manifold. It may be something like this with corners on it or something more complicated. It doesn't have to be say this is a manifold with corners in this case. And then the second point is a point of notation. I want to refer to lots of different U's that may pertain to different manifolds. Okay. So because of that, it's useful to introduce this label here. U, which is a bit confusing because it looks like the thing I'm defining needs U. When U is a subscript, it's regarded as a label just to indicate that this particular instance of a manifold is the one associated with this particular classical description. Okay, is that clear what I'm doing here? Okay. And then we have, you know, some part of the manifold. Then we can put coordinate system down on all of this or part of it, depending on the topology. We can consider diffeomorphisms, where we transform the point P to the point phi of P. That's a diffeomorphism. And then we can also act on this classical description itself with a diffeomorphism. So I'm going to write that like this. All I've done is I've acted with a diffeomorphism on each element. So when you act on tensor fields like this, there's a prescribed way to transform them under a different morphism. The point goes to a new point, and so on. Actually, you can just, because this is just a dummy variable, you can change it to Q. So this is just taking a classical description like this and acting on it with a diffeomorphism. And if you have a coordinate system down, then this diffeomorphism will implement a change of coordinate system. So it'll take you from, take you to some new coordinate system. Okay. Right. So let's return to the quantum side. So the first thing I want to do, first of all, let's just write down a... We can consider a path integral for this kind of situation. Which is like this. So we're just integrating over the different possible classical descriptions. And then we have an action here, which is calculated by integrating a Lagrangian in an appropriate fashion. And we do this with respect to paths that are in some appropriate set, so the ones that have the appropriate boundary conditions. So A can be the boundary conditions. This is the set of paths that have these boundary conditions. So now, now I want to just do some sort of notational gymnastics, notational pseudo. So we have U over here, which also appears in this path integral. I'm going to put brackets around it like this. This is a bit like this, except that this point here suggests it pertains to a single time, whereas this extent here suggests it pertains to a duration. And because this manifold is a four-dimensional manifold, it's associated with space-time, not just a single time. Okay. So this notation is suggestive. In the paper, the notation does a few more things as well. There's an interesting kind of scalar product you can define that pertains to this type of situation. Okay. And now one thing you can do, okay, and I think at this point I'm going to start abridging. One thing you can do is to consider something like this. Equal to So what I've done here is I've taken one of these square bras, and I've put a coefficient in front of it and integrated it over different paths, and I can do that in some set V. So for the paths that belong to some set V. Okay. So this object, if this set here, V of A, is contained in V, then all the information you need to calculate the path integral is already you have over here. Okay, it contains the same information. But it looks more like a quantum state. One can do more tricks here in the paper. I have more to say that makes this seem like a more reasonable thing to consider. So now, and more generally, we might just be interested in having some coefficients here. Cu, okay. So let's just consider pictorially what this might look like. So we have a superposition of many different manifolds with some fields defined on them. Ah, I see the problem with this chalk system. Thank you. So that's meant to represent the different fields, plus a similar kind of thing. A different manifold, different fields. Okay. Okay, and so on. And of course, it's really an infinite sum, not a discrete sum like I've represented here. Well, we can think about various things we can do on this kind of object. One thing we can do is perform what I call a quantum diffeomorphism. See, if we can use, if this is an operator in the old notation, then in the new notation you have a square kind of hat. Okay. Okay. And now what we can do is we can define this, which is meant is a quantum diffeomorphism. And what it does is it acts separately on each of these terms. So it's kind of a U-controlled diffeomorphism. It acts separately on this term and this term and this term and so on. So you can implement you have this option of implementing a different diffeomorphism on each of the manifolds in this superposition. Another thing you can do is place down what I'm going to call a quantum coordinate system. So a quantum coordinate system is like this. You have some region here, which you label with x's. And now you identify points here with points in here, and so on, throughout each of the different manifolds. And so on. OK, so every point in here is identified with a point in here and a point in here. So this quantum coordinate system has two parts to it. It has a kind of classical part, which is just an X label attached to the different points in the different points in any given of these manifolds. But it also has a identification structure. So this point here is identified with this point here and this point here. So this is what I mean by a quantum coordinate system. It also tells you what I mean by a point. So a point is a point in a quantum coordinate system. So here's a point here. These three things constitute a point. Okay. So
to understand, when one fixes the coordinate, usually gives some prescription to fix the coordinate and in some intrinsic way. So.
I'm not fixing the coordinates in an intrinsic way. People often do that. You often choose a coordinate fix, like a coordinate gauge or something. I'm not trying to do that. I mean, that's done. So the reason for doing that is you want to find a solution and you want a full set of equations.
For instance, yes.
But those gauge fix, those coordinate fixing conditions have no physical meaning as such.
But then how do you do that in practice? I mean, if you have an infinite...
That's fine. I mean, that's part of the situation is that you have, there's many different coordinate systems, many different ways of, you may want to choose a coordinate system which is physically useful to you. But a priori, you can choose any quantum coordinate system you want, is the idea.
Okay, maybe I can jump in. A related question. So don't you want to identify systems that are related by quantum diffeomorphisms? Or that are physically distinct?
Yeah, so here's a general point here is, so in the quantum reference framework that Firminier and co-workers have done recently, you associate the quantum coordinate system to a particular physical system. Okay, and then relative to that, you set up your coordinate system. But if you look at general relativity, the X label is on top of the manifold, but it's not relative to any particular fields. It's sort of, it's conceptually prior to the physical systems, if you like.
Physical states are typically those that are invariant under diffeomorphisms.
Right, but what I'm saying is that the general coordinates you put in place are logically prior, or conceptually prior to any physical systems. And what you can do is you can look at a solution. You can say, this is anticipating a remark here. You can say, I want to choose, well, in the case of general relativity, you can say, I want to choose a coordinate system that's useful for the particular physical situation I'm looking at. So that might be one that tends to be where the same x position tends to be located in a particular, you know, peak of a particular physical field or something like that. And over here, you can do the same thing. You may say, well, I've got some fields that I want to associate with a measurement apparatus. So I'm going to choose a coordinate system, a quantum coordinate system that identifies the places where that same physical field is peaked in some way, or has certain properties. And if you do that, then that will be a useful quantum coordinate system from the vantage point of that measurement apparatus. But you might have chosen, well, that might be a physical reference frame, but you might have chosen a different system to do the same thing. So that kind of connects this idea with the idea of the Vienna group. So let me just finish. There's a few more points, and then I'll wrap up. So if you act on this situation with a general quantum diffeomorphism, then you're affecting each of these things differently. And what that will do is break the identification structure. You can use that to induce a different quantum coordinate system. And it will, in general, break the identification structure. I should say, by the way, that Ding, quite separately from me, came up with this identification kind of structure. He wasn't thinking about it as a quantum coordinate system, but as a means to do certain types of calculations. But it's sort of intriguing that the same mathematical structure came up for two different reasons. Yeah, okay, so if you change quantum, if you perform a quantum diffeomorphism as a way of changing your quantum coordinate system, then you can do two things. You can both, change the classical description, so change the X label, but more significantly, more quantum, I would say, you can also change the identification structure. So instead of identifying the points that I've drawn, I'd like a different piece of chalk. Yeah, it's just white. Orange, that'll do. This point here might now be identified with this point and with this point and so on. So the identification structure changes. And that kind of change of quantum coordinate system might be a good way to change the different representations. Okay, so maybe advantageous from different points of view. And in particular, this will be a way of implementing the quantum equivalence principle. Because what you can do at a certain point here, okay, a certain point in the original white reference frame, I can rotate, I can use diffeomorphisms, controlled diffeomorphisms that rotate on each of these, so that if the light cones were originally not aligned on here, then after this rotation, the light cones in the different terms become at this point become aligned. Okay, so the causal structure is now definite at that point. So this is a way of implementing the quantum equivalence principle. And the other important point is that if you take this quantum diffeomorphism seriously, then you would get a way to have an interpretation. So your Biables would be over here. Would be things that were invariant under general quantum diffeomorphisms. And so this is potentially a much richer, deeper sort of structure than the classical diffeomorphisms. So this might be a way to really look at, address some of the interpretational problems. So maybe I'll finish there and then I'll take questions. Thank you.
classical configurations over which you sum, are they supposed to solve the classical equations?
No. No, because just like in the path integral homism, you know, like just a simple example, the classically described, they don't solve the classical equations, and just the same is true here. They wouldn't
how
solve.
How do you achieve so the equivalence principle shouldn't, like if it doesn't hold individually, are you able to enter into inertial frame, or you don't claim that, you just want to have a definite causal structure locally? But it doesn't yet have inertial.
Yeah, I think it's conceptually more interesting. I mean, you could also push it to then become inertial, and that would be a further step. But conceptually, the thing I think that's at play here is indefinite causal structure. So that's the important point, that you can get to definite causal structure. Then it's just another step to make it inertial.
In terms of an arbitrary classical configuration, if it's not obey the Einstein equations, then maybe there is no way to actually implement the classical version of it.
I think as long as it's sufficiently smooth, I mean, if it's really, as long as it has sufficient smoothness properties, then I think it's fine. As far, I mean, I believe that to be the case. I haven't. Yeah.
Well, so I guess I have two questions. One is more a particle physics viewpoint. You haven't said anything about gravitational and inertial mass. And so what puzzles me a bit about the quantum equivalence principle is, for example, there are particle physics models where gravitational eigenstates are not weak eigenstates, or put another way, the different neutrinos could couple to gravity differently, but the causal structure is definite everywhere. So I would say that's a violation of what I would understand an equivalence principle to be, but I don't see how it would fit in with that.
So to answer that question. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of discussion. There's a nice philosophical paper by, which I cited in the most recent version of this. Is it Craig? Callan? No. Okay, I'll give you the reference when I. Oh, Craig Callender. So, Elias Ocon and Craig Callender, who discussed the issue, you know, this kind of issue about the quantum equivalence principle. And of course, there are situations where the sort of original, you know, the original notion of Einstein doesn't quite work. But if you broaden what you mean by the equivalence principle, you can resolve those. And so I think maybe that would be the place to go
look. I'm not objecting to the definition, but it doesn't seem to me that it incorporates that aspect of it. That's all I'm saying.
But
you could have a gravitational mass not equal to inertial mass and apply this or not.
Yeah.
They seem decoupled.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, just like the equivalence principle, if you just talk about inertial behavior rather than, you know, then there was a broader concept, then it might be. So, for example, in quantum theory, you can find these examples where.
Broader concept doesn't include the pound of feathers weighs the same as a pound of lead concept. That's
right.
All I'm saying.
Yeah. Okay.
Whereas normally one thinks of it as doing so.
I mean, I think that's right, but that's really a problem on this side, on this side of the quantum classical divide. This is an analogous principle, not the same principle meant to do something.
This is the analogous to the what would be called the Einstein equivalence principle.
Right. Yeah.
So the other one is just, it's a very interesting idea. Is there any instantiation of this idea in some particular kind of theory or dimensionality,
where
you can calculate some transition amplitude or something?
Which idea do you mean? You mean this idea? I think that, you know, when I spoke with Carlo, he seemed to think that this was, you know, this was exactly a property they would have in standard quantum gravitational models. So. And he immediately agreed that this would be, you know, you would want this kind of quantum diffeomorphism invariance that I'm describing. So I mean, I'm not as much of an expert on these models as I should be, but I think it would apply to many of the different models of that sort. I mean, the point here is to try and make this principle do some work.
I'm kind of asking what kind of work it could do depending on how it's instantiated.
Right.
Like, is it different in loop gravity or string theory, or is there a one dimensional two, you know, one plus one model? Or
I don't know. I don't know. Vaslav is the chair.
I mean,
you place emphasis on the causal structure,
yeah,
the definiteness of the causal structure.
Mm.
Now, there's this theorem that says that if you know the causal structure, if you know the location of the light cones,
mm-hmm,
then you know the metric.
Up to the factor.
And that's what I'm wondering. You're almost looking at all of the metric.
You're just
looking at the causal structure.
Yeah.
You cannot go all the way.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I thought of calling this the weak and the strong quantum equivalence principle. You could go one step further. And actually, so that would now be the clocks should tick at the, you know, in this reference frame. This will now be like clocks ticking because you want to get the conformal factor as well. So you certainly could do that. And I think the construction I showed, there's no problem with actually getting the conformal factors to match as well. But it might be interesting to consider a statistical mixture of a different conformal factors or not. But the reason I'm specifically interested in causal structure is because it's always seemed problematic to me to implement causality conditions. So in quantum field theory, you have the commuting, this idea that space-like operators should commute, and here in the vicinity of a point, you could do something like that. Or in the operational literature, there's the sort of the Pavia causality condition, which says that the identity effect is unique and is a different way of implementing causality. But within definite causal structure, you can't implement the Pavia causality condition. And so my conjecture is that what's going to happen in the addendum here is that it's going to concern a generalized notion of causality condition, that some notion of causality condition which takes into account that you have to work in this quantum coordinate system is what you're going to see. But that's just a conjecture.
I want to ask a question about this analogy. You formulated the equivalence principle in a relatively formal way, but there's sort of a more informal one where you could just think of the elevator thought experiment,
mm-hmm,
Einstein's starting point,
mm-hmm,
if you imagine that the physics and accelerating,
mm-hmm,
elevator through free space is the same as one that's at rest in gravitational field, you get a really natural explanation, mm-hmm, of why all masses should accelerate at the same rate.
Right.
You just take the physics you know about inertial motion, mm-hmm, redescribe it relative,
mm-hmm,
to this new reference frame, and
you
get a nice explanation of things you've seen in a different context.
And so before
Einstein ever started appealing to non-Euclidean geometry, he had this clear and distinct idea of why it was a plausible principle to endorse. And so I'm wondering if there's something analogous for you, that is it conceivable that we could have following, even though we don't have some sort of notion of a definite causal structure that's in need of explanation,
mm-hmm,
which would parallel Einstein's need to explain the phenomena of gravity,
mm-hmm,
even though we don't have that, do we have anything like, here's a situation with definite causal structure, and now I redescribe it relative to a quantum reference frame, and lo and behold, it looks like indefinite causal structure.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we had that, it would seem like you'd have such a conceptual basis of why it makes sense to enforce this quantum. But in the absence of that, it seems like we don't have a solid foundation yet. Like, why should I believe the quantum equivalence principle unless I have at least one example of indefinite causal structure looking like definite causal structure in a different reference frame? Right? So that's kind of my question. Like, what evidence do we have of that?
One problem, of course, is that the world of general relativity is more familiar to us, whereas the world of truly quantum gravitational effects is less so. But it would still be nice to describe at least a Gedanken experiment of the sort you described that would do that. And I thought that referring to clocks in some way, that clocks would be the natural object that would replace the elevator. But I don't think I have a clearer formulation as what you're asking for. Yeah, please.
Maybe a similar situation is not really in definite causal realm, but if you would be following in that superposition of gravitational fields, maybe you would be just really following, just like if you would be following in a definite gravitational field. That's maybe some operational vision. It's not about the causal order, but it's about superposition of metrics.
So you said this notion of quantum coordinate system was based on the kind of quantum reference frame. framework where you associate a quantum system to a physical physical
It was motivated by that. Yeah.
Yeah, and so then you can associate quantum systems to kind of delocalized systems. So I was wondering if you could, maybe as a test of this, for instance, just in GR, just start to associate quantum systems to like classical fields, for instance.
Right.
A formulation of classical GR, which has this like, similar background where you associate quantum systems to delocalized objects and see if you have something consistent.
So so you can do that. Like if you, what you can do is you could nominate four or more scalar fields. So these could be fields that have been constructed out of the fundamental fields that you have available to you. And then you could you could look at coincidences in the values of those four different scalar fields. And those could if things work out appropriately, those could represent, those could be used as a physical reference frame, an actual physical reference frame. And then you could, in this quantum kind of picture, if this full scalar fields would exist in each term, you could try, you could find a quantum coordinate system that identifies the points that have the same coincidence values for those four scalar fields. So that would be a way to extrapolate it to the quantum case, and that would maybe be the best connection with the work in Vienna. One thing you don't have is the parity swap. I think getting rid of any part of your Hilbert space looks dangerous in this context.
So regarding this comment about how maybe this can be useful, look indeed like you're doing path integral quantum gravity, you introduce this concept. And maybe one way, just a suggestion, in which it might be useful is like you might actually be able to define a good gauge, kind of quantum, fixing a good quantum coordinate system, a quantum gauge that might simplify quantum gravity.
Oh, right. Oh, interesting. Yeah. That might connect with the sort of thing Dinger's thought about, because Dinger's used. Did you want to comment on that, Ding? What, did you hear the question? Sorry?
Please go on.
No, no. So, Anyon was saying that this might be a way to find a good gauge fixing with respect to which to do a calculation. And I thought that might be one way of describing what you were doing, sort of. Okay. Yeah. Question for Lee.
Yeah, this may sound peculiar, but what's wrong with the ordinary equivalence principle?
Oh, it's yeah.
No. In just holding on to it as we dive into the quantum gravity.
Right.
The ordinary equivalence principle is really has this unique relationship to the principle of inertia. And the principle of inertia is like the founding principle of modern physics. And it survives to special relativity, to general relativity. The idea is if you let go of everything and there's a special class of motion where you don't feel the effect of motion, why can't we just take exactly that idea into the quantum realm?
I think one can and one should. But I think, this list of principles needs to be, need to add more things to this list up here to really get theory of quantum gravity. But the question I was really interested in, which I should have used as a motivating example earlier, was the one I mentioned of causality conditions. I'm not sure how inertiality connects with implementing, either the usual commuting operators approach to causality or the Pavier approach to causality that I mentioned. And I was always worried about that problem. How are you going to impose causality and connect with previous causal physics? And this principle seems to offer a chance of doing that, which the original equivalence principle doesn't seem to do at all. But that's
maybe this is just misnamed. The principle you're looking for is something that says the violations of the indefiniteness of causal structure is not arbitrarily bound.
They can be tamed.
They can be tamed.
This is locally tamed. Yeah.
You need to tell us what local means.
Yeah, well, local. Now, if you have a coordinate system, then you have got a notion of local because you have this quantum coordinate. Because in a particular quantum coordinate system, you have these labels X, and that tells you what local means. Yeah, so you have that.
So in your definition of quantum diffeomorphism, if you understand it's like a conditional operation that
yeah.
You have two degrees of freedom. One is like the manifold, and the other is anything else.
The field. The
change by diffeomorphism. And then your definition is that essentially for each manifold, if each classical manifold, you apply some classical
yeah.
diffeomorphism. Now, if you take these words on quantum reference frames, these are all within one manifold. So one has a change of reference frame that looks like a quantum change of reference frame, but just within one manifold.
No, it's a bit more, actually. It's also this quantum diffeomorphism is also, they can see all of what's happening inside this square bracket. So they're controlled on not just the manifold, but also the fields that are on there. So that makes it more similar to the standard quantum reference frame's point of view.
What do they act on? I mean, because I understood as a controlled operation, it makes sense if you have, say, two degrees of freedom, the manifold and the things you want to act on.
Oh, right. Okay. Maybe calling it controlled was the wrong thing. So a quantum diffeomorphism has associated with it a set of diffeomorphisms, one for each possible u, and then when it acts on this, it applies the appropriate diffeomorphism for the appropriate u. Maybe I shouldn't have called that a controlled operation.
The next question, is there any guarantee this ends up being a unitary, or does it have to be unitary?
No, I don't think it's. Let's see. The set of quantum diffeomorphisms isn't even a group. It's a monoid because you have the identity one which does nothing. And if you apply any two quantum diffeomorphisms one after the other, you get a quantum diffeomorphism. But one thing that can happen is you can have two terms which look different, but they're actually diffeomorphism equivalent. So you could apply a diffeomorphism of the sort I describe and take them to the same thing. And then you can't undo that, so it's not an inverse element.
Yeah.
So in your summation, you don't take different configurations, so you may take physically equivalent configurations.
These can be physically equivalent. Yeah. One thing what I've described here is what I call the restricted set of quantum diffeomorphisms. There's a bigger set where you allow sort of coherent mixtures. So one thing you can do is you can apply quantum diffeomorphisms to take you to a case where you only have one representative example for each possible one. You could try to map them all to the. You apply a quantum diffeomorphism so that you get rid of degeneracy of that sort. It just takes you to the. Does that make sense? Yeah. So there's definitely. So these are questions I haven't thought about very carefully. But the overcounting in that measure needs to be thought about. Yeah.
So the coordinate system in classical, they are not attached. You can attach to a physical system, but you cannot.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you're freedom of choosing independently, whereas in quantum reference frames, very often that represents quantum reference frame. When you change the biggest reference frame, you change the reference frame to another, can you even get entangled?
Yeah.
So it seems like it's not obvious that you can have coordinate systems without attaching any systems.
Mm-hmm.
I have a problem. Is it possible to do
I mean, I think just what I've described attaches quantum coordinate systems to. And maybe I don't understand your question. I mean, you can certainly do things here. The motivation for indefinite causal structure was the idea: if you have a superposition of different causal structures, maybe you can get rid of that by a quantum reference frame transformation. So that kind of thing happens here. Just how analogous it is, I don't know. That
has to be. Related to facts. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
In which case this would be entangled state in the system or not?
Yeah. Yeah, here it isn't conditioned, and I think that does make it different. And it potentially makes this monoid of diffeomorphisms, quantum diffeomorphisms, sort of different from what we used to. It may be interesting. Okay.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.